I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about historic preservation. The Athenaeum recently became a National Historic Landmark. We're going to talk about what it takes to become a landmark and what goes into preserving these treasured pieces of our past. My guests are Cassie Stockamp of the Athenaeum Foundation, Tina Connor, Executive Vice President of Indiana Landmarks, and David Frederick with the Indiana Landmarks Sacred Places Indiana Program. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about historic preservation today on No Limits. There's some big news in Indy recently regarding historic preservation. The Athenaeum received designation as a National Historic Landmark, and Indiana Landmarks capped one of its most successful campaigns with the refurbishment of the what we still refer to as the old L.S. Ayres clock downtown, even though L.S. Ayres has not been a presence there for many, many years. My guests are Cassie Stockamp. She is with the Athenaeum Foundation. Tina Connor, who is the Executive Vice President of Indiana Landmarks, and David Frederick, who is with the Indiana Landmarks Sacred Places Indiana Program. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, we're going to start the show. Actually, WFYI's Michelle Johnson managed to capture some of the atmosphere regarding the restoration of the famous L.S. Ayres clock. I'm sorry, I'm old enough. I'm allowed to call it that. The L.S. Ayres clock, and I thought we'd listen to that to kind of set the mood.
Yeah, to come to Ayres. You know, I can remember coming here and buying Christmas presents for everybody. That was a big ritual, you know.
I always remember coming down to Ayres with my mom. We would take the bus over, and I just remember we always, you know, this was just an iconic building. And the clock, and also the tea room. I mean, it was a package deal.
The dedication, originally, they referred to the clock as our loyal clock. And so I think part of loyalty means, you know, being on time. The fact that it was broken is just too bad. So now it's fixed, and it's loyal again.
Exactly at 12:12, all four faces of the clock will start yet again. It's already moving. Let's give a big celebration that our clock is back.
And that was sort of an audio portrait of the restoration, the completion of the restoration of the iconic L.S. Ayres clock in downtown Indianapolis. Again, we're talking about historic preservation on No Limits today, and my guests are Cassie Stockamp, Tina Connor, and David Frederick. They're all associated with preservation and restoration in some fashion. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
It's good to have you here. I'd like your thoughts. I mean, this is kind of a, I guess, somewhat a pun intended here, a landmark period for Indianapolis. We've got these two, you know, important pieces of the city's cultural history that have been either designated or restored, preserved in some way for the future. Can you talk about what the meaning for of that is for this community? I'll start with Cassie first on that.
Oh, I think it has so many different layers. From a historical context, signifying the Ayres clock and the Athenaeum, those two, as it was mentioned in that audio, iconic pieces that people then start to realize that, oh, these are important to our community, that we need to continue concern that they are assets, that we need to make sure that they're preserved, that we donate to them, do we help maintain these structures. So it has many, many layers in my mind of what the significance means.
Tina.
Well, I think people have memories that they would like to see preserved. That was certainly true of the Ayers Clock, and I'm sure of the Athenaeum as well. But it to me, it's also a matter of civic pride and a matter of visual interest. Mm-hmm. You know, if you imagine a city without any historic buildings, it would be pretty bland and boring. Even though we love modernist architecture, you have to have a mix, and so you have to pay attention to the best of the old stuff and make sure that it sticks around.
David.
Well, I think Tina hit a number of the very important reasons of why preservation is important, and that memory is key to that. Certainly, you mentioned having been around the city for a long time, mm-hmm. that Ayers clock is important to us who grew up here and went to see the mechanical Christmas displays in the window and then got, you know, chicken velvet soup and at the Ayers mm-hmm. Tea Room and got to ride the Santa train, all of which have been one way or another have been preserved. I like that these are just two kind of high-profile examples of some things that are going on consistently in Indianapolis. We could name a number of other projects and programs. The Naval Armory is another mm-hmm. great project that Landmarks is currently working on, helping Heron School turn that fabulous Art Deco Naval Armory into a second school. And where there are examples all over the state of why historic buildings, spaces are important for our memory. I think it was John Ruskin who says, a city without its buildings is like an old man without his memory. That's
mm-hmm. Well, and in that spirit, I mean, there's the, you know, we talk about sort of the motivation here to do this, why it speaks to us. There is a process, though, that I don't think as many people are aware of. Could you talk with me, and we'll start with the clock since that's where we were, but we are going to get to the Athenaeum's designation. Tina, in terms of what the process was for going about restoring the clock, where did that start? How long did it take? Who was involved, and what did it cost?
Well, it started in late August when two members of Landmarks came to us and asked us if we could help to get the clock running. One of them, Mary Cummings, lives in Lockerbie and walks a lot, and she walks past the clock all the time, and it just got to really bother her that there were four different times on the four different faces, and none of them was correct. And she asked Paul Smith for help, another member of ours, a former board member who runs the Southeast Neighborhood Development Corporation and kind of knew his way around the city. It's a city-owned building, and so the clock is owned by the city. But the city has a lot of other priorities, and we said, sure, we think we could help. And we launched a media and social media campaign to raise what we thought was going to be $20,000 until we discovered that there were a lot of other deficiencies than just the fact that the clock didn't run.
What were some of the other deficiencies?
Well, the faces were really faded mm-hmm. And needed to be replaced, and so that was more money. The clock was originally lit from within in 1936, and that didn't work anymore, and so we would decide, well, we should put that back, too, the light. Mm-hmm. And then we realized that the case of the clock, the bronze case, we thought it was all bronze. It's not. It's only partly bronze, was in bad shape. It weighs 10,000 pounds.
Wow.
And we knew it needed some cosmetic attention.
A whole lot of people who walk under that thing very nervous. Right.
Well, the guy who repaired it, you can stand up in it. It's that tall. And the fellow who was working on it said, I'm not standing in the bottom of that clock. I'm afraid I might end up on the sidewalk. And it's 30 feet up in the air, so that would be damaging.
Yes.
And so we increased the goal to $60,000, and we launched that campaign on October 25th once we knew we had to find out who could restore it and get bids, and hired Smith's Bell and Clock from Canby, Indiana, to do the repair. And this is just of the clockworks, mm-hmm. not the case. And And all of a sudden we realized, oh, my gosh, it's in a historic district that's locally designated. We have to get permission from the Preservation Commission, which you'd think Indiana Landmarks would have had that foremost in our minds. But what was foremost is that we wanted to get it fixed before November 23rd when the cherub arrives, if most of your listeners may be aware. Mm-hmm. But we have this tradition of a bronze cherub arriving on Thanksgiving Eve to perch in the crook of the clock. And he mysteriously disappears on Christmas Eve.
So it was then about a $60,000 project?
It will be. We're going to restore the case in the spring.
Okay.
And that's by far the more expensive piece. And then we had created a maintenance fund. So some of the money will stay in a maintenance fund so that we can do annual clock cleaning, which will keep it running, and repairs if something breaks. And That should be done every year, and then the conservation of the case should happen about every decade or so.
Why, David, why? Because it sounds like from a historic preservation project, this was pretty fast-tracked.
Oh, very.
Very fast-tracked. Yeah. Why was it such a priority?
Well, I'm not sure I can really answer that. It's a priority because people were interested in it and responded to it so quickly, but it's also just such a big part of our downtown. And
well, and sometimes a deadline focuses you pretty acutely, and that, I mean, when we thought, okay, the cherub is coming, don't we want people to look up and see the right time?
Yeah.
Because they're going to be looking up for the cherub. So that was the pressure, really, time.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about historic preservation here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what Kevin has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. How are you? I'm a loyal listener.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
Well, I grew up in Indianapolis and lived probably more than 50 years of my life there. Mm-hmm. And I grew up. Well, I was born at Methodist Hospital, and we lived at a house, a three-story Victorian mansion at 18th and Pennsylvania that does not exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And my comment is that for 40 years, I have watched the city of Indianapolis abandon the inner city, the homes, the historic homes, handcrafted homes that were built more than 150 years ago, one after another, just allowed them to deteriorate and disappear from the landscape. And so when they talk about historic preservation, I knew a fellow when I was a teenager who went along Delaware Street and bought homes and refurbished them. And I don't know if they still exist. I know he's passed on. But now we talk about all this historic preservation, and we're down to the Anthoneum, Heron School, and Ayers Clock. This is sad what Indianapolis has done, because I have lived in Chicago and San Francisco also, Berkeley and other places in California, where historic homes are preserved at all costs. There are mansions today on North Meridian that if they were in Chicago or San Francisco would go for $4 or $5 million.
Mm-hmm.
And
Kevin,
he has just allowed this neighborhood after neighborhood to just deteriorate.
And, Kevin, let me let these folks have a chance to respond. But thank you very much for the call and the observations.
Okay.
Thanks much.
Thanks.
Well, Tina, I'll let you go first.
Okay. Well, Kevin, I kind of wonder when you were last here, because nearly all of the neighborhoods that surround the downtown core are historic districts with restored houses. And it kind of moved out from there. The movement, I would say, began in Lockerbie and the Old North Side and Chatham Arch, but then it has spread out and as far as Irvington and certainly the North Meridian Street Historic District, which has been preserved and protected. So we pay attention to Hawville and the Near East Side and all around the city, Woodruff Place, Fletcher Place, north, south, east, and west.
Chatham Square.
David, yeah, you want
well,
to say something?
I mean, certainly there was a time in the 1960s when the Indianapolis' downtown was being abandoned. There's no question about there was flight from the urban center, and that was absolutely hard on city and those neighborhoods. But as Tina's pointed out, there's been a concerted effort over the last 30, 40 years to work on downtown neighborhoods, and there's been terrific results in many areas.
And I think we're going to talk about how we set priorities when it comes to historic preservation when we come back from the break. We are talking about historic preservation here on No Limits. My guests are Cassie Stockamp of the Athenaeum Foundation, Tina Connor, who is Executive Vice President of Indiana Landmarks, David Frederick, who is with Indiana Landmarks Sacred Places Indiana Program. I am John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or find us on social media. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about historic preservation today on No Limits. My guests are Cassie Stockamp of the Athenaeum Foundation, Tina Connor, who is Executive Vice President of Indiana Landmarks, and David Frederick, who is with Indiana Landmarks Sacred Places Indiana Program. We've gotten an email from a listener named Brittany, and if you'd like to reach out to us via email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. This one is for Cassie. Says, rumor has it there are some exciting new businesses coming to the Athenaeum. Can you tell us more about this and what's next for the building?
Oh, yay. That's a great segue. We are in the middle of a renovation as we speak. With all the incredible activity on Mass Ave, we just started to look at our building and say, how are we going to remain relevant? How are we going to continue to serve? And there were really a couple of initiatives. One was Plan 2020, as well as a velocity study that took place. And one spoke to the needs of attracting and retaining millennials, you know, nothing new. And the other spoke to this notion of third space. And third space was a new concept for me. First space is home, second space is work, and third space are public gathering spaces. Mm-hmm. And we really have become a public gathering space. We had almost 1,900 events last year, 800,000 people grace its doors. It's a heavily traveled, beautiful old building, but it's very tired. And so in assessing what is it that we can do for the community, we had some underutilized space and, excuse me, mm-hmm. and realized that
yeah, we're all battling a
certain amount of congestion. Yeah, it's that time going around our nose. Yeah. That we could convert some space into a coffee juice bar. Mm-hmm. And so we're bringing in a couple of local millennials that have started a company and are going, and we're little in the middle of converting the space into something really pretty outstanding for downtown Indianapolis. So,
well, I want to talk a little bit about that, about how you use spaces like this that have a historic role and a place in our, you know, in our cultural and community memory. How you repurpose them in ways that are appropriate mm-hmm. and redefine them, which, you know, everybody, there's a reason everybody's turning and looking in your direction right now, David.
Well, good. It's my turn.
Yeah.
Although repurposing is the kind of how you predicate that question is not something that I'm working on. Mm-hmm. I'm working in kind of a subsection of the preservation world right now, and I am running a program that focuses on capacity building, stewardship training for congregations and parishes and historic religious buildings. Mm-hmm. And the important point that Cassie made is this places mm-hmm. That are have a public face as well mm-hmm. as an internal use, mm-hmm. and one of the main ways that we're trying to help congregations and parishes is to help them kind of look anew at the how they're using their space, learn how to share that space better, and make it more pertinent in their relationship with the community.
What are some of the ways that you encourage them to share the space?
Well, you'll find there's been some research. Studies done that are kind of surprising, that about 80% of the people that use a sacred building, a congregation or parish's building, are not members of that community. This will be from artistic performances, food pantries, AA meetings, that kind of thing. Often this is part of what the congregation does as part of their walk in faith. They don't really think about it as being a connection to the community in a broader sense. So part of it is helping them be strategic thinkers, strategic planning, to kind of turn their face back to the community, see how they're connected to the community, so that they can ask the community for help in maintaining what are important buildings for the, both the faith community and the broader community.
I would think, Tina, this is pretty important effort for Indianapolis and Indiana in general, which has occasionally been referred to as the buckle in the Bible belt.
It is. You know, yeah. David brings congregations that are chosen to participate in Sacred Places Indiana. We choose 8 to 10 congregations a year for this 3-year program that's funded by Lilly Endowment, a pilot project. And he brings them into Indiana Landmark Center, which is in a repurposed 19th century church that was once the largest Methodist church in the state. And he says,
it's the old central,
don't
right?
let this mm-hmm. happen to you. Mm-hmm. You know, if you are in an active congregation in a historic building and you've got troubles and your congregation is declining, but you want to figure out a way to stay, one of the things you can do is look at all the space you have. In general, these large inner city historic older churches were large and they grew over time. They have additions. Mm-hmm. But now the congregation is much smaller. And so they have excess space that could be used for other purposes that might generate revenue and generate traffic and people who might become members of the church. So,
if you are just joining us, we are talking about historic preservation here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do what Linda has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Linda, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What's on your mind?
I was wondering if anybody knows what happened to the Zaring, Z-A-R-I-N-G, Egyptian theater when my grandparents lived around 18th and Capitol. We used to walk to that theater to see shows, and it was scary as heck because they had mummies in the lobby and all kinds of stuff. If anybody has any answer on that.
We'll see what we can get for you. Thanks very much for the call and the question.
Thank you.
If she could email me at Indiana Landmarks, I can look up when it was demolished. But the Zaring was demolished, although that Egyptian craze was very popular at a couple of different points in the last couple centuries. And it got a huge boost in the 1920s when King Tut's tomb was discovered. But even before that, there had been excavations that caused this spate of Egyptian architecture to occur in the middle of the Corn Belt. And the old National Center has the Egyptian mm-hmm. Theater. Mm-hmm. The Masonic Temple at 11th and St. Clair in Illinois has an Egyptian room that's fabulous.
You can even find some examples in an incredible Indiana Methodist temple in Versailles, Indiana, the Tyson mm-hmm. Memorial Temple, an all a glazed block, mm-hmm. Art Deco Egyptian church. You won't find those very many places.
Well, I want to pick up on Kevin's call and comment about sort of the priorities when it comes to historic preservation and the missed opportunities, because, you know, this is a greatly different city now than it was even 30 years ago. I remember I went away to grad school, lived in St. Louis, came back here and thought I'd have a similar kind of experience to what I did living in St. Louis. And I took an apartment, this is in the early 1980s, right downtown Indianapolis, close to, David's pantomiming a yawn right now, which is, it really was almost the cliche that they rolled up the sidewalks at 5 o'clock in the evening. There's a lot more vitality. There have been changes, but there's also a much more, you know, it seemed like there was very little focus on preserving the city's past at that time, and then it kicked into high gear pretty quickly after that. Can we talk about first how the movement to preserve this city's past got started, Tina, but I want everybody's thoughts on on this, and then how we decide something is worthwhile to preserve.
Indiana Landmarks was formed in 1960, so before the 80s, but and by a group of civic leaders, mostly men, including Eli Lilly and Herman Cranert from Inland Container, who were powerful people and who thought they needed to do something so that things like the English Opera House, English Theater on Monument Circle would not be lost in the future. Yeah. You know, we have grown to be the largest preservation organization in the country. And so we are able to do things that a lot of preservation groups can't do. And we started in the 70s. The bicentennial was a big impetus for preservation, the National Bicentennial. And then the a tax act in 1966, even before that, in 66, that created tax incentives for restoration, especially of income-producing buildings like you find down in downtowns. And those two things, that Preservation Act and the Bicentennial, were really kind of a spur to preservation in Indianapolis and in Indiana generally.
I mean, it's a relatively new movement. Really, it's the 60s when you start seeing a developing national appreciation of preservation. I'm just back from the National Conference for the National Trust for Historic Preservation. It was held in Houston, Texas. That's a city that has never had a zoning ordinance. So you think about how hard it is to protect
the
neighborhoods.
You can see what that looks like, too.
They, in fact, they've created a park where they have moved what they consider important examples of historic buildings into a park. And one of my colleagues says, well, it's kind of like a house petting zoo. They've got one from each little era, but there's big blank spaces in Houston that you can't find any coherent neighborhood. And there has always been, there's a little tension between it's my property, I want to do whatever I want to do with my property. If I want to sell it and make money, look at farmland around Indianapolis now. Can I sell it for my best price, or do I have to conserve it for agriculture use? So there is that tension, and some of it you can make impact through legislation, local district ordinances, and that kind of thing. But a lot of Landmarks work is advocacy and education and convincement.
Well, how do we, and I'll take the second part of my question then, is how do we make the decision about what, you know, for example, there's a McDonald's in my hometown that I spent a lot of time at as a kid. Has some meaning to me, probably not so much to the community at large. As such, how do we make the case that certain places are worthy of these dedicated efforts to preserve them? I'm going to start with you and Cassie, because you had to make that case with the Athenaeum.
Well, and it was long before me, obviously. So in the building was built in 1894. So clearly there was a huge insurge of this immigration population and enthusiasm. And then with the wane of the downtown, the urban flight. So in the late 80s, early 90s, it was close to demolition, I understand. Birds flying in the building. When it rained inside. It was close to falling down. And there were a group of very strong Germans, academics, that understood the historical significance of that building and did some severe jockeying and negotiations and pulled Indiana Landmarks into it and were able to start the foundation. And we now have a permanent exterior covenant on, or an easement on it. So anything we do to the structure, we have to get approved by them.
And that was because we were approached for help back in the 80s because a fellow on our board was a vice president of Indiana National Bank, which held the note, the mortgage for the Athenaeum. And he discovered internally that if they had to foreclose, they would likely tear it down because the land was more valuable for parking at that time. So we bought the note. Indiana Landmarks bought the note from the bank. And some months we got paid and some months we didn't. You know, that's a long time ago. I think it was around $350,000.
Which is a steal now.
Yeah, well, and that is a really a luxury that many, many states do not have because of Mr. Lilly's generosity and good stewardship by the people that have the board and the executive folks at Landmarks over the years. Many, many statewide not-for-profit preservation organizations could not possibly do that. They don't have an endowment that size or a cash availability. So we're really blessed in Indiana for an organization like Indiana Landmarks.
Mm-hmm. So I want to come back to the question, though, Tina. I'd like your thoughts, too. When Indiana Landmarks decides, how do you make the decision that something is worth preserving? Because I'm sure you get more requests for help than you can possibly satisfy, that there have to be criteria.
There are, an easy one is it eligible for the National Register? There are criteria to be listed in the National Register. That's kind of an official capital L landmark. And it's not that we wouldn't look at something that didn't meet that threshold, but it has to be at least 50 years old. That said, we helped list 7 buildings in Columbus, Indiana that were modernist landmarks that weren't quite that old. But we thought it was really important, and the federal government agreed with us because the federal government is the ones that maintains the National Register of Historic Places. In the case of the Athenaeum, it was an unaltered building that really still served pretty much its original purpose, which is from 1894, an unusual thing. And it was built by a Vonnegut. I mean, the architect was a Vonnegut. Yeah. A lot of reasons why that building was kind of a no-brainer to save. It was on a corner at the juncture of 2 different historic districts. It's important to save corners if you can.
Yeah.
So for a lot of reasons, the Athenaeum was really important.
Other than that, those are the obvious. Where are the judgment calls?
Do people care about it?
Mm-hmm.
Is there money that can be raised?
Yeah, we help form local preservation groups all over the state because we think that the people who live in a community or a neighborhood are the ones who know what is important and what needs to be saved, and then we'll help them do that. But we don't prefer to come riding in as a Lone Ranger because that is usually very expensive. And we've done that, like in West Baden. But usually we go where people tell us they really care about something.
And to do that, we probably ought to give, since there are people, I'm sure, Kevin obviously, had places he cared about. If they wanted to reach out to you and say, hey, you know, would you focus on this or give some attention to this, how do they go about doing that? What's the process?
They can email us at info@indianalandmarks.org, go to our website and subscribe to our e-letters and get in touch with people that way. We have 9 offices around the state, and on the website each office is listed with the territory it covers, and those people who run those offices really know their geography and might already be aware of the building that somebody's concerned about.
Cassie, in terms of the designation as a National Historic Landmark, how does that change the way that the Athenaeum operates, if it does at all?
Yeah, good question. But first I want to let you know, it was a big deal. It took, how long do you think it took?
Well, I'm guessing the real process started back in the 80s. But, yeah, so about 30 years. But out of that, a decade?
Close to 8 years.
Yeah.
It took us 8 years. So we were on the National Register 3 times. And we started this process back in 2008 and worked with the Indiana German Heritage Society, donated the money to help provide for that funding. And Bill Selm did literally years worth of research. We had to compare ourselves to other buildings around the country. We had to come up with an area that the feds were really felt that this was significant, because it's not just about the architecture. It's about the storytelling. It's about what does this mean to the history of the country. And so this building is significant.
There are only 41 National Historic Landmarks in Indiana.
Yep.
And this is one of them.
The Athenaeum's the 41st.
Yes.
We are talking about historic preservation here on No Limits. My guests are Cassie Stockamp of the Athenaeum Foundation, Tina Connor, she is with Indiana Landmarks, and David Frederick, he is with Indiana Landmarks Sacred Places Indiana Program. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Thank you. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about historic preservation today on No Limits. My guests are Cassie Stockamp with the Athenaeum Foundation, Tina Connor, she is the executive vice president of Indiana Landmarks, and David Frederick, who is with the Indiana Landmarks Sacred Places Indiana program. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what George has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. George, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. Very interesting. And I wondered if your guests could talk about the role that money and finding money plays in historic preservation, because I heard a number of prominent individuals, high net worth individuals and organizations mentioned playing key roles. And I know, for example, that Eli Lilly was mentioned, and in his will, one of his concerns before he passed was with the exodus from the inner city that the three Episcopal churches, Christ Church Cathedral, Trinity, and then St. Paul's at Kessler and Meridian, would not survive as independent parishes. And whether preservation of the structures was a goal of his, it certainly had that effect of keeping, you know, Christ Church as a great addition or a great reminder of the past on the circle. So it seems like money is a key at all times, and maybe your guests could tell me how you find money, what the goals are, and how that plays a role in historic preservation.
Thanks very much for the call and the questions, George. Yeah, somehow when George was talking, I was reminding, there's an old joke that used to make its way around the not-for-profit world. And the premise was you ask the question, you know what the problem with tainted money is? Taint enough of it. So, David, well, I could see you just about leaning into the microphone. Yeah.
It's, of course, an important concern in all preservation activity. Staffing, rehab costs, everything. It's particularly an issue in the area that I'm working in. And he mentioned three terrific examples that are not particularly candidates for my program. Mm-hmm. Because, and there are still churches like that. There, but they, Christ Church, Trinity, St. Mm-hmm. Paul's, all endowed. Mm-hmm. They have the luxury then of being able to meet issues with a historic building head on. They can take care of it the way congregations and parishes have traditionally taken care of their building, that is internally. If there's a problem, you get up to the pulpit and you talk to the parishioners or the congregants and you say, we need to do X with the roof. But since the 50s or so, and of course, there's a decline in mainline church attendance, not mm-hmm. just in Indianapolis or Indiana, but in the United States, Western Europe, Canada. and that's a formula that can lead to a real threat to historic churches. There is a declining static congregations that equals declining static contributions, that equals deferred maintenance, that equals threatened historic buildings. For churches, that's kind of the trick and the key for what we're trying to do is help them, since they can't take care of it by passing the plate an extra time or doing an additional fish fry or something like that, learn how to reuse space, share space, but also take a more strategic look at their story, reassess who they are, where they've come from, and what they have, and then be able to delineate the kinds of things that they are providing for the community so that they can tell their story in a broader sense to the community and get some help support externally. We also give them some real nuts and bolts capital fundraising help as well, because, again, there's a shift between take care of it internally the way you always do, which is by small events,
and a campaign.
Yeah.
Well, and I was going to say, in a thumbnail, you say those three churches aren't really candidates for your program. In a thumbnail, who are the candidates for your program?
Well, there's a kind of a continuum, and I think I just kind of gave you the ones that who are in the sweet spot that really don't. It doesn't sound sweet to them. There are some that haven't churches that don't need us. if you're in Indianapolis, you know the Second Presbyterian, a large congregation, huge numbers on Sunday, have some more of ability to take care of it internally. Endowed churches like the Episcopal parishes we mentioned, there are some on the other end of that continuum whose numbers have gotten so small or so aged, or usually that there's a combination of both there, aged and declining numbers, and a building that has overwhelmed them, that it's not easy to help. So there's a group in there that still has enough folks coming on Sunday or on Sabbath day, I should say, because we certainly work with synagogues as well, who have enough leadership, congregant and pastoral leadership, and a will to view new things and think strategically, that we can kind of help in that middle ground.
And I see we've got a lot of calls coming in right now. So I'm going to ask our listeners and actually my guests as well, let's try to be brief and try to get as many of these questions in as possible. We're going to go first with Richard. Richard, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The Walker Building, the monument to Madam C.J. Walker, one of the first African-American entrepreneurs in the entire history of the United States, have a building with failing elevators and HVAC system that doesn't work. Are they on the list of places that you might be helping?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Richard. Tina, we'll go to you.
I believe Indiana Landmarks has tried to be helpful in the past, and we certainly regard it. It is a national historic landmark, like the Athenaeum, one of the 41 in Indiana. So it is definitely of great importance. I know Lilly Endowment has been helpful in the past, too. And if there's something we can do, we would certainly like to try to help.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Ann, and if you'd like to reach out to us via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Ann writes, is Indiana Landmarks involved in trying to save the woods at the north end of Crown Hill Cemetery? If not, why not? Tina.
I'm afraid I don't know the answer to that. We have a central regional office. Mark DeLossi is the director of that office that covers Marion County. And I will find out when I get back to the office if we have been involved in that or not.
Okay. So if people want to follow up with you on this, I would suggest, if you would not mind, the three of you, if there are questions that pop up after we go off the air, visit our Facebook page, and our listeners monitor the Facebook page, continue sending questions or comments there, and we can continue the discussion even after we go off the air. We're going to take another call. If you'd like to join the conversation by phone, call us at 866-476-3881, as Tim has done. Tim, welcome to the program.
Thank you, and thank you for allowing me to join in the conversation.
Certainly.
I'm thinking perhaps I should have made this phone call 2 or 3 years ago. I'm a former parishioner of Holy Trinity Catholic Church, and it's located on the west side in Hawville, and the archdiocese closed the church, citing rising maintenance costs and a declining parish population. Those are very real issues. But I can't help but think that some agencies, some organization could have stepped in and said, well, hey, let's take another look at that before you pull the plug on it.
I'm going to let David take that one. Thanks very much for the call.
Well, this is a treacherous area, an outside secular preservation organization telling a religious organization what they should or should not do with any of their buildings.
Oh, there are risks associated with doing that, David.
There's, and it is a particularly the issue in Roman Catholic dioceses is that it's they make broad diocesan decisions.
But there is an example in southern Indiana where the Catholic Church had marked four parishes for closure, and it speaks to David's earlier comment about leadership and energy. There was a priest down there who had a lot of parishioners of these four to-be-closed parishes who got together, and they raised money, and they had this idea that they combine all four churches into one parish but keep all four buildings open, and they raised enough money to restore all four churches.
And I'll ask a question, then I do want to get back to callers. on this, but what is the, you know, we keep talking about how there are places that don't need you at the high end and then some that are sort of beyond help. What's the tipping point? Where is the point roughly where it began? Because I'm sure there are some people who are listening to this program who belong to churches that are beginning to feel a little marginal. What is the point of no return?
Well, and I think that's a subjective place. I mean, in our very first group that we worked with, we brought in a Jewish congregation from Terre Haute that were down to about 15, 20 people worshiping together, part-time rabbi, but there's so much leadership and determination in that remaining few that they were eligible. I've visited with congregations that still have 100 on a weekend that don't have the will or the vision to continue on, but I'm not sure that I could give you a little checklist.
Well, then let me ask the question. How do you go about making the decision about whether you can get involved or not? Because you have to have some criteria where you say, okay, I'm going to commit my time, my energy, my resources to doing this.
Well, it comes from a variety, several site visits and consultations and meetings with church leadership, both pastoral and congregational. We have a list of kind of a self-assessment form that will include, do you have strong lay leadership? Do you have strong pastoral leadership? Do you have ownership of a building? Can the local congregation make a decision, or is it in, say, like the Catholics, that's kind of more of a top-down decision. So I have 10 or so.
12-point.
Yeah.
And how many of the points do you have to be able to check for you to say, like 8 or 9 out of the 12?
Yeah, I suppose that's right. It's on a case-by-case basis. We're learning this as we go along. It's new territory.
Hmm. We're talking about historic preservation here on No Limits. Amy, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
My question was, my husband and I live in Mapleton in Fall Creek, right down the street from 33rd and Ruckel, and there's a building there that's called the Bethel Temple, and it looks like they've been doing work on it recently, so I was just wondering, like, maybe when it was built and what it was originally used for and maybe what they're going to do with it now.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Amy.
Bethel Temple was a Jewish synagogue, and it is now owned by Indiana Landmarks. And we are trying to find a new use for it. And as you can imagine, with a building like that, it's on several levels and not easily accessible and has one huge room with a soaring domed ceiling. And so we need to – and a lot of space. And so we need to find a new use for that building. We investigated a preservation trades program, which – we think there are a lot of restoration-related skills that are disappearing, and we think Indiana needs a restoration trades program. Oh, and so that's one thing we've looked at, trying to attract someone who would operate such an educational facility in that building. And we've also bought a house or two on that block to try to shore up the whatever happens with the church. Sometimes you just have to make a building look less scary. Yeah. That's what we did with West Baden. And I think, you know, with Bethel, we put a new roof on it with help from the city and Mapleton Fall Creek Neighborhood Development Corporation. And and the Ephraimson Fund of the Central Indiana Community Foundation all were contributors to that roof project and getting it cleaned out and getting the environmental issues that it has cleared up. And once we've made it less scary, I think we'll be able to attract a new use.
Gotten an email from a listener named Sean, and our email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Will you please bring up the great phenomena, urban exploring, to your guests? There's some incredible Indiana videos and some really incredible videos from all over the world on YouTube. The secret abandoned military bases are great. There's some jaw-dropping buildings out there that nobody would have known about had it not been for the brave urban explorers. Many places are not wheelchair accessible, so that leaves me out. Sorry about that, Sean. Also, having spent a lot of time at Riley, I have a bunch of stories. Are they really thinking of tearing down the old Riley Hospital? And he says, thank you and keep up the great work. Tina, you're frowning.
I don't know.
Is that frown or confusion?
Yes, I'm sorry that I don't know if they're going to tear down the old Riley Hospital or not. I will try to find out.
So that raises, I think, a question. You guys, the three of you, because of the work you're in, look at this city, this community, with different eyes than many of the rest of the people. You know, the past is sort of imprinted on the present mm-hmm. for you. Using the example of Riley or other places like that, what is a place that really is not a focus of preservation right now that should be? Something that we really should be thinking about preserving, committing to ourselves. Tina, you made the mistake of looking up and making eye contact first, so I'm going to go with you. But I want to hear everybody's thoughts.
I'm embarrassed that I don't know the answer to the woods at the north end of Crown Hill. And
you think that is should be a priority?
Well, I think that is a part of Crown Hill, which is a landmark cemetery. Mm-hmm. And cemeteries, it's not easy to get cemeteries on the National Register of Historic Places. So the fact that it is a National Register landmark, and that includes everything in it, nature as well as monuments.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, that was going to – mine was – good heavens. What came to mind was parks. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have historic structure to it, but it has significance in so many ways. And Eagle Creek has so many beautiful old lily buildings that are truly falling apart. And as we know, the park system just doesn't have the means to continue to do those improvements.
That's a great answer. We're trying to save the Taggart Memorial in Riverside Park. And we have a special task force that we created because we knew that the Parks Department just wouldn't be able to come up with that kind of money.
And we formed a new historic landscape committee at Indiana Landmarks to begin looking more broadly at not just individual buildings, but buildings and context, mm-hmm. And that's so
like
certainly
boulevards, tree-lined, curving streets that sometimes departments of transportation want to straighten out and kind of ruin.
I think they're getting it now. Calm streets are a very important part of our community.
Well, and I think that probably is an appropriate last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Cassie Stockamp of the Athenaeum Foundation, Tina Connor, who is with Indiana Landmarks, and David Frederick. He is with the Indiana Landmarks Sacred Places Indiana program. I'd like to thank all three of you. This has been an illuminating conversation for me.
Terrific. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah, certainly. Thank you. No, thank you for being here. I also would like to thank our listeners for many great questions. We are not going to be on the air with this program on Thursday. There's going to be Thanksgiving programming in its place. We will be back next Tuesday, though, when we're going to be talking about philanthropy and the changing face of it for Giving Tuesday. I am John Krall, and before I bid you farewell, I want to say Happy Thanksgiving. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cherzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.